So thank you very much for the organizer, and it's a tremendous time to be here because the two previous lectures just introduced what I'm going to speak, so I can go a little faster. In fact, I am tempted to speak of two subjects which are slightly different. The first one would be on topoisomerases, as we just heard, and the second one would be on the replication fork and the interaction between, as we have heard, the helicase and the primase in the replisome. So they are just very in the perfect timing. To do that, I think I will have to squeeze a little each of them because it's a long story in our case. So I will do that and I will explain the shortcut that I'm using. So be careful, I'm trying to cheat a little to make things a little more simple than they are. So first, we are in a lab, in a physicist lab in Paris, and so we are using and we have been developing magnetic tweezers to look at DNA and enzyme working on DNA. And I will try, I don't think I need to show you the motivation here because we have heard about this replication fork problem. We have heard about topoisomerases and topology. So what I will just show you is the technique here in the system and how does it work. So the technique is quite simple, it's sketched here. So the idea that we have is that we want to be able to look at a single molecule and to be able to twist it and measure things like the movement of an helicase or the action of a topoisomerase. To do that, we have noticed that it was very simple. We need some way to see a DNA molecule, and DNA molecule is only DNA molecule and enzyme can only work in water with a small amount of salt. So you are bound to use an optical microscope. Optical microscopes are very nice, they are simple, they have only one drawback. Resolution is limited by the wavelength of light, and this is the resolution is typically 200 or let's say 500 nanometers depending on the way you use them. So it's impossible to see a DNA molecule, and so if we want to look at a DNA molecule or an enzyme, we need a way to report where this molecule is, and so we bound to a DNA molecule, a small bead here, which is not to scale there, but the bead is micron in size, and if we succeed to attach this bead to the surface here, we'll have something which show where the molecule is, and this is what we are doing. Now, this bead is actually a small magnetic bead, and we just use permanent magnet as designed here to apply two things. First, if the magnet is like that, there is a strong horizontal magnetic field there, and a very strong vertical gradient, field gradient in that direction. So the bead tends to be pulled in the middle of the two magnets, and so it is pulled up by those two magnets. And a nice feature is that if you use conventional magnets and beads which are commercially available, you just get the force in the nice range of piconewtons that is required to stretch a DNA molecule, and this is what we are using. But this is very simple, just place magnet on top of a microscope. But you can also do something more interesting. You can actually turn the magnet around the optical axis here. So the vertical axis here is the optical axis of the microscope. If you rotate the magnet in that direction, then you are able actually to turn the bead around. And if you have done proper interaction between the DNA and the bead, then you are able to twist the DNA molecule. And this opens a way to look at those topoisomerase stories. So let me first show how we catch a single molecule here. Maybe some of you have already seen that. So we have heard about replication forks. So we can either in this apparatus place single DNA molecule, double strand, single strand, or two DNA molecule, or a single strand DNA molecule mimicking a replication fork. And this is what it is. So here what we are using here is a single strand DNA molecule. And to make a replication fork, a small replication fork in the system, we have designed the molecule so that there is a palindromic sequence. So it means that the DNA tends to form an hairpin, and this hairpin will spontaneously, so there is a loop at the end there with no base pairing, but here a lot of base pairing. And so this will spontaneously fold down and make an hairpin. And then there are two pieces of single strand there which are non-complementary, so they won't fold anymore. And so you, in fact, prepare a Y molecule, a fork, in this design. And this is a perfect substrate for looking at helicase and primase, not what Dr. Rosenberg did. So to be able to actually do something with that molecule, you need to manage a little way to catch both ions. And the way to do that is you use biochemistry and you attach biotin on one ion and dioxygenin on the other ion. And we tend to put more dioxygenin because dioxygenin is not so strong as biotin. Now, if you use streptavidin-coated bead and you mix those molecules in a test tube with this bead, then they will spontaneously attach by the biotin ion. The molecule will spontaneously attach to the bead by the biotin ion. And so this goes in the test tube. And of course, what we want is that at the end, we have only one molecule per bead. And so there is no way we can actually go in the tube and say which molecule should go with which bead. So what we do is we just use a large number of beads, a small number of molecules. Well, when I say large number, it's millions, but we change the concentration of DNA so that there is little chance that there are, most of the beads have no molecule, and some of them have one molecule. When you have to construct that, then you just flow those beads and the solution that they are in the capillary tube that is our sample. And this capillary tube, in advance, you had treated so that there is anti-dioxygenin on the surface. Okay, so you code the enzyme which recognizes the second end of the DNA molecule. And the nice feature is that those beads are slightly heavier than the water, so they fall on the bottom of the chamber. And since there is, at that time, no magnetic field, they are free just to move around by Brownian motion. And you do see them moving around and floating around. And they fall on the ground, and at some points, the DNA molecule will find its dioxygenin and bound. Okay, but as I've said, most of the beads don't have a bound DNA molecule, and so most of the beads won't bind to the substrate. In fact, a few beads will also bind to the substrate and stick to the substrate, and we can also use that. And some, of course, of the molecule will actually be usable and will be bound by a DNA molecule. So here we have lots of beads, and a lot of them are not attached to DNA. So we need a way to get rid of those beads, and the way is very simple. You just flow gently the sample, the chamber, and this rinses out the solution, and it takes away most of the beads. And one of them is staying there just in the middle, and you can see that it's slightly moving, so it's not actually stuck to the ground. In fact, it's attached by a DNA molecule. So here the DNA is very small. I'm sorry, the hairpin structure is very small, so it's difficult to see by eye what is going on, but I'll show you that. So when you have finished rinsing, then you can bring the magnet on top of the sample. So what we have here is a typical apparatus. So you may not recognize it, but this is a microscope. So the objective is here below. This is a small chamber where we have injected the molecule. And on top here are just the magnets that I've shown you before. And what you don't see here is that there is a hole in the magnet, and the light for the microscope is coming from the top through the magnet there. Okay? And so once you are finished rinsing, then you can bring the magnet, and this magnet will pull up the bead, and then you can see the beads directly, and you have all the other beads which are flowed around. And at that time, what you see is you see something on the screen like that. You see basically nothing everywhere and a few beads there, which are attached, presumably to what you are is a DNA molecule here. So this is the way the apparatus is designed. Now, what can we do with that? As I've said, you don't see DNA. The only thing you see is a bead. And I'll explain that the force is vertical. So you are pulling the bead in the direction of the microscope. And so what you need now is you need a way to measure what is going on. And what we are going to measure is the position of the bead. You understand that the vertical position of the bead will just give you the extension of the molecule. And the idea is that if there is no force, the bead will be on the ground. If you pull strongly, then the DNA will be stretched, and the length, the extension of the molecule, will be just the extension of the DNA molecule that you have at that force. So it's not easy to measure position along the focus position of the microscope, and so we use a small trick here. It's very easy to measure the XY position on the microscope. It's a little more difficult to measure the Z position. And in fact, to measure the Z position, we use those diffraction rings that you see here around the bead. And what I'm doing here is just showing you in real time what is going on. If you move the objective of your microscope to get unfocus from the position of the bead. And as you can see, at the beginning, you nearly had a sharp image. I was a little above the focalization point, which I stayed. And so at the beginning of the system, I can replay that here. So here I'm just above, slightly above the focus position, and you see that there are very sharp ring and very tight ring. And as I go off focus, you see that the ring goes larger and larger and dimmer and dimmer. We get those rings because we do something very bad with microscope. Normally on a microscope you have a very wide field illumination. Here we use a parallel illumination, and when you do so you have some interference occurring, and this is what we are using. And so most of the time you don't want this interference, and they will disappear if you have a wide angle illumination. So what you see here is that those small interference give you those rings. And the rings have two things. They change in size. So the rings become larger as you get out of focus, and they become dimmer also. And the nice feature here is that you can actually, with nowadays computer, you can invert the problem. You can look at those rings and say, imagine that I just take the radial profile of the bead. I can actually compare this radial profile to this picture and say, well, now the height of this profile was taken at, let's say, 33 micron here in this diagram. So your computer can actually measure the Z position of the bead just by looking at the ring around the bead. Okay? And the nice feature of that is that the resolution is very good, and so you will get a resolution of a few nanometers in X, Y, and Z. So let me show you a final image. So here, for instance, I'm showing a small movie where we see two things. The first thing, I'm pulling here on the bead very hard, and now I'm decreasing the force. So I'm bringing up the magnets just in the middle. And so you can see two things, two different things. So here, I measure X, Y, Z of this small DNA molecule. And so X, Y is just a position, as you can guess in the screen. And the Z position is just the extension of the molecule. So what is very simple is that at the beginning I was pulling hard, a few piconewton, and so the DNA was just stretched to basically full extension. So this is a 2.6 micron molecule, as you can see here on the stuff. And then I decrease the force very much to a very small range. So I move up the magnet and then the force goes down. And you see that the extension shrinks quite a bit. And at the same time you see more and more fluctuation, because if there is very little force, then everything gets more sloppy and you get more fluctuation. But the nice feature now is that you can look at X and Y fluctuation, and what you can see is that if I pull very hard, my small pendulum is very rigid. The bead and the DNA make a small pendulum, and this is very rigid. Okay, so it fluctuates very little, as you can see here. On the contrary, if the force is very low, okay, then this pendulum is very soft, and you get a lot of fluctuation. Of course, they are bound by the DNA molecule. So what you can see here is that from the Z measurement, you get the extension of the molecule. From X, Y, you can actually deduce the force which pull on the bead just by using Einstein relation. And so this, you can actually directly calibrate your force by measuring the Zivonian motion there. So I think I'm done with the apparatus. So with this apparatus, you can easily apply a force. You apply a constant force and you can calibrate this force, and you can actually measure the extension of the molecule. So this is a constant pulling force, and now if I rotate the magnet, the force is kept constant because the magnets are at the same height. Okay? Now, what can we do with that? We have heard a tremendous thing about topoisomerases, and so of course it's very tempting to look at topoisomerases with this apparatus. So you have heard that Topo2 is able to disentangle DNA molecules. And we want to work with single molecules. And of course, in in some occasion, so we have to be sure that we have a single molecule in our apparatus. So there is a very simple way to be sure that we have a single molecule in our apparatus, is if you rotate the magnet, and if there is a DNA molecule there, usually two things can occur. It's either a single molecule or two or three. If it is two molecules, you understand that as you turn the beads, then you are going to untangle the two molecules, and by this process, the extension is going to shorten. Okay? So if you rotate and something shortens, it means that either you have several molecules, either you have one molecule which is sensitive to torsion. But if nothing changes when you rotate, you know that you have a single molecule, but you know also that it is nicked. Okay? Because then, if there is a nick, you can rotate the free end of the molecule and nothing happens. So it's very simple that you have a single nick molecule. It's more difficult to know that you have a molecule which is unnicked. But it turns out that one of the students found that in some occasion you get two molecules, and he found a trick to actually recognize those two molecules, which is very simple. So the trick is, as you can see on the drawing, if there are two molecules, there is very little chance that they are attached on the same spot on the bead. Okay, so roughly speaking, this should be something like that. And I'm sure you have played with a swing when you are young, and you have twisted the swing at some occasion, which is not the normal use of the swing. And when you do that, there is a tremendous instability of the last half third. Okay, and it's very funny to twist it a lot and ups as this brutal jump at the end. And so when you twist it half a turn in one direction or in the other, you actually cross the two DNA, the two DNA molecule. And when you do so, you change quite substantially the extension of the molecule by doing so. And this is very simple. You can actually compute all the math of that. It's just pure geometry. It's very simple. And it turns out that this change of extension is significant if the molecules are not too long compared to the distance which separates them. So we have no way to impose this distance between the two molecules, but it is going to be related to the size of the bead, okay, roughly speaking. And so the test to see if you have two molecules is very simple. You turn half a turn in one direction, zero, half a turn in the other direction, and if you see your molecule extension changing from maximum extension at zero, and a sharp decrease at half a turn, and a sharp decrease at minus half a turn, you are crossing two molecules, definitely, okay? And so it's a very nice way to see that you have this DNA molecule. Of course, you can go further, you can turn more and actually do a braiding experiment. That is, if you twist molecule more than just half a turn, you will braid the two molecules and form something which will shrink with size, as you may guess. And so this is a very simple way to actually braid two molecules. And this is a way actually to look at catena and string that we have heard this morning. And if you can go further, there is another instability where you actually see exactly the same thing of what is occurring on my... Yes, there is even a knob there, I believe. When you twist the DNA molecule at some points, there will be plectonemes which will occur. So this occurs on single DNA molecule. It also occurs on catenane DNA molecule, and there is a very sharp transition between the two there. So I'm not going to discuss about that. So the nice feature of this very simple experiment is that if you just not rotate half a turn, but rotate just one turn, you have by definition, a single catenane between two DNA molecules, and there is only one on these two beads, on this bead there, on these two molecules, and you can do that really at will. So we will use this substrate to actually look at. We have used this substrate to actually look at topoisomerases, especially at topoisomerases 4. So let me show you that. Just before that. Let me just show what is going on when you twist a single DNA molecule. It turns out that twisting a single DNA molecule is a little more complex than braiding two DNA molecules. So if you twist a single DNA molecule, which is sensitive to torsion, it's very simple. If you just crank up the number of turns that you apply on the DNA molecule. This is a lambda phage DNA that has 16 micron lengths typical at full extension. So the behavior will actually depend on the force that you apply. So if you apply a small force, 0.2 piconewton here, and twist the DNA molecule, very quickly you form those splectonemes and you shorten the molecule. And it does not depend if you twist on the positive side or on the negative side. You form the structure in the same way as on my mouse code there, and it will not depend on which way I'm recording. You will get the same kind of structure, except the symmetry will be different. Now, if you do the same thing at higher force, you see, so 1 piconewton here, you see the same behavior, and again you see plectoneme here on the positive side, clearly. They occur, but of course, as I'm pulling stronger, the molecular extension is larger. And also you see that there is a definite threshold before I actually see those plectonemes. Okay? And this you expect normally, because there is an instability going on and there is a threshold for this instability. The only thing here is that the threshold is so small that we don't see it for this case. There is here something very different, is that you don't see the instability on the negative side. And the reason for that is that DNA is a double helix, and so it knows about torque. And so if you turn the molecule by this mean, you can apply very strong torque on DNA. And it turns out that in the red curve, the torque is so large on the negative side that you can actually melt the DNA here. And so you form a denaturation bubble in this experiment. And so this prevents the observation of those plectonemes. So, since I've said that, now I can show you the same experiment. We can use this kind of experiment to actually check what is going on topoisomerism. So we have heard a tremendous introduction on TOPO4, and I just show you very briefly what we can do on TOPO4. And so the big issue is to understand how this enzyme, so TOPO4 is a TOPO2 enzyme, I'm sorry, and so what it does here, it does what exactly is on this diagram. So it is able to catch two double-strand DNA molecules and get one through the break of the other. And so if you do that, you could imagine that in principle, well, the first thing you thought is that it shouldn't depend to the arrangement of the molecule. Each crossing should lead to a change, an enzymatic action. So this is true for TOPO2. TOPO2 actually doesn't care about the topology, and it actually removes those twisting independent of the chirality. TOPO4 is actually able to sense very clearly if it is a positive or a negative supercoiling. And so people are also trying to understand how does the molecule recognize this supercoiling state, which is a very large state compared to the size of the molecule. So what we have done is a very simple assay here. This is a single molecule experiment showing that TOPO4, as we have heard, acts very differently on positive and negative supercoiling. So how do we do the experiment? You take a single molecule, you apply a very small force, 0.3 piconewton typically, and then you twist your DNA. And here, the nice feature of single molecule is you can change the supercoiling state of the molecule at will. Just rotate the magnet in one direction or in the other. It's very simple. If you do that, if you twist the DNA molecule, what goes on is that its extension just shrinks, as I've shown you, due to this supercoiling instability. If you add some TOPO4, the TOPO4 will relax the supercoiling, and so the extension is going to raise. Okay, and this is what you see here. In fact, if you have positive supercoiling, the enzyme is very active and removes supercoiling very quickly. So you resume very quickly the extension at zero supercoiling state in just a few seconds. If you add negative supercoiling, so this is here an enlargement of this graph here, and you see that it is very fast. In 10 seconds, it has removed all the supercoils that we have done in this molecule. Now, if you look at the negative supercoiling, it's a very, very bad activity. You see here that this runs for 3 minutes, and we have cranked up the concentration of TOPO4 by 20-fold to actually be able to compare the two situations. So what you have here is TOPO4 is very very efficient in distinguishing positive and negative supercoiling. The effect is drastic here, because basically if we use the same conditions as in the positive case, we see no activity on the negative supercoiling. Okay? So how does an enzyme is capable of recognizing the symmetry with such an efficient manner is not completely solved, but I'll try to show you that we have a way to understand what is going on there. So what we have done is try to compare the symmetry of the two things. So as we have heard, positive supercoiling is equivalent to L brace, that is to catenate with the opposite geometry, and of course we have the same for negative supercoiling is equivalent to air braid. And so this means that there is an angular change between the two structures, and there is a special symmetry in this problem. So if I have the two DNA molecule, what will count in fact is that if the crossing angle is 90 degrees, I cannot recognize the symmetry. Okay, so what you have here is that in this condition, you have a small angle alpha between the two molecules, and in this condition, you have the same thing, but the geometry is reversed. You can switch from this one to this one by taking the angle pi over 2 minus alpha, and then you resume the same condition. So there is a symmetric point which I want to stress, which is around 45 degrees for alpha here, which means that the two molecules are crossing at 90 degrees there. And then you cannot distinguish if it is L-braid or L-braid. Okay? So how can we test this idea? The idea is very simple. You just take a 2-DNA molecule substrate and you twist it by a turn. As I've said, when you do that, the molecule extension is going to change drastically, and you are going to have a single crossing in your DNA molecule there. And you can do that very simply on the positive side or on the negative side. And of course, what we want to test is how does tuple 4 relax this situation, depending on the sign of the thing. So let me show you what we see. Okay, so this is a small recording. Here it's not tuple 4, it's tuple 2, but it's the principle of the experiment. So here I just turn the magnet of one turn, and the enzyme is in the solution. And you can, each time I turn by one turn, the enzyme comes in and relax the thing. And so you can see that the relaxation is quite fast here. So here I've done three turns. Each time I move there. And since I turn, the extension just decreased because I cross the two molecules. Then I stop turning and I wait. And the enzyme is able to find the crossing between the two, and it relaxes, it gets one molecule through the break. And so it destroys my entanglement and releases the two molecules straight. And when the two molecules are straight, then there is no way the enzyme can work again. Okay, so I can see a single enzymatic event by this mean. And what you can see here is that the time, so this is the time needed for the enzyme to find the substrate and do the enzymatic step. So you can actually test one enzymatic step at a time in this experiment, and as you can see here, the enzymatic time is variable, and you expect that because it's a single molecule experiment, and it should be Poisson distributed, and it is Poisson distributed. So what you have now is to do statistics on this substrate to actually understand what is going on. So what we have done here is we have compared the two situations here by crossing positively, by left crossing or right crossing in this experiment. And what I just want to stress here is that this crossing is very dependent on the angle. So here is the point where I'm cheating. You can have two different situations. If the two molecules are very near, you get two different angles. So if the two molecules are very close to each other, then you get a very small angle between the two molecules. If the two molecules are attached very far on the beads, then you get a larger system there. And so what we found here is that, I'm going to say that the crossing angle between the two molecules is this geometrical angle. This is not true,
But this is a long story. It's nearly true. Okay, so this is the point where I'm shifting. So what you see here is very simple. You see that if the angle between the two molecules is very small here, then the molecule is very sensitive to the fact that it is a left or a right crossing. And so here in red, so this is in red here, it's a left turn. We turn on the left, and you see that the relaxation time is very short. And if we turn on the right, you see that the relaxation time is very long. Okay? Now, if we have two molecules with... So this is a large angle. This is the asymmetry that I'm explaining. So if I have a very large angle, then what I found is that the waiting time between right and left is roughly the same. Not exactly, but nearly roughly the same. So what you can do, in fact, is measure this ratio between toe left and toe right versus this angle. And from that, you can actually infer what is the preferred angle of this enzyme. And this is what we have done. And again, I'm making a long story short here by cutting through the details. And so what we found by this is this kind of result. That is, we find that the preferred angle for this enzyme is 85 degrees. Okay, so this is the angle where the enzyme is mostly active. And so what is surprising is that this angle is not very far from the symmetrical enzyme, so symmetrical angle of 90 degrees. But this is the result that we have, and I think everything now is coherent there. So from now on, I will switch to the second subject, and I leave you the question to know more things about topoisomerases. So we have heard this morning thing about the replication fork, and I'm going just here quickly to show a work on the replication fork. And this work was not done on RegJ, but it is done on another kind of enzyme. This is a collaboration with Steve Benkovich group in Penn State. So Michel Spiering has been doing the work, and most of what I'm presenting is done by a Spanish woman, Maria Manoza. Here. So the T4, so as we have heard, the replication fork is a very complex system. And the T4 virus is interesting because it's simplifying to some extent the replisome, but not too much. So this is the same picture as we have seen this morning, the replisome of T4. And this replisome involves 8 enzymes. In our cell, it's far more. So as we have heard, there is an helicase opening the double-stranded DNA. There is a primase here, which make a small primer so that the second polymerase can actually build the Okazaki segment. And there is a first polymerase, which actually synthesizes the leading strand. So what I'm going to focus on this morning is how the primase and the helicase are working together. And I'm not yet going to speak of the full replisome. So the name of the helicase is GP41. We have heard the DNAB, so it's very much like the DNAB, and the primase is GP61 for those that are interested. So what is the question? The question is very simple, is how this thing is working on L. So the helicase is working in that direction. So basically the helicase is an exameric system, and there is a single strand DNA passing through the hole. And you can imagine that this helicase is pulling on the single strand. And by pulling on the single strand, it's actually unwinding the DNA. Okay? And as it does that, there is a primase which is just behind, bound to the helicase in principle. And the primase must put on a small primer so that the polymerase can actually synthesize the Okazaki segment. And so one first thing which is bad is that this helicase is going in that direction, and when primase is active, it's going in the opposite direction. How can those two guys work together, okay, if they are pulling in opposite direction on DNA, on the single-strand DNA? So there are various models that we can discuss. So the first one that you can imagine is that, well, it may very well be that if those two enzymes are working together, well, they have to wait each other, so that one is working and the other one is working on the other end. So this would mean that if the helicase is moving around, when the primase is going to act, it is going to stop. And the primase is going to do its small job, and then the helicase will resume activity. Okay, so this is the first model, and this is the tosing model. And this has been seen for T7, but T7 is a little special. T7 is a virus where primase and helicase are fused together, so they cannot escape. Okay, so it's only this model which is possible. You can imagine a second model where the two enzymes dissociate. And so the idea is that as long as they are well together, the helicase is unwinding DNA, and as soon as primase is working, then it stays where it is on DNA, and helicase goes forward, and there is a gap in between the two enzymes. And so this is a dissociation model. And you can imagine a third model where, in fact, they like so much that they stay together, and instead of and still they have to work in opposite directions, and the only way to do that is to pop out a small loop of DNA there, a single-strand DNA here, and so this is a looping mechanism that we can see here. So how can we test this? So the assay, as I've presented, is very simple. So the idea is that we place here a DNA molecule which mimics the replication fork in this system. So this is the apparatus that we have already seen. Now, if you pull on this DNA substrate, you can unzip DNA, and there is a finite threshold for that. That is, most of the time, if you have a small force, the hairpin is more stable, and the extension of the molecule is basically zero, except for single strand. And at some point, the molecule pops open, and it opens completely. Okay, you have completely unzipped the DNA molecule. And if you pull further, you are pulling on single-strand DNA. Now, if you go back, there is an hysteresis loop, and the idea is that, in fact, it costs energy to actually reform this hairpin. And so there is a waiting time before you actually get the reforming of that. And so this hysteresis loop will depend on the speed at which you do the job. But basically, you get a curve where it opened at 15 and it closed at 12 to give a number here in this system. So this is pure mechanical opening of DNA, and there no helicase is working. So if we want to do something here, I will skip that, it's okay. Okay, so now what do we see if we add the helicase? So right now I'm just trying to explain what is going on if you just add the helicase, and next I will show you what goes on when you add the primase together. So if you add the helicase, this is a small recording of what is going on. So also here we are having a force which is smaller than 12 piconewton, it's 9 piconewton, so there is no chance that the molecule will pop open due to the force. And there is some helicase in the solution, and at some point the helicase finds its way through the DNA and opens it, and it does it again. And it does it in an interesting way here. So what you see here, this is that most of the time in the recording, the extension is zero. So you see no extension, well, zero. The hairpin is closed, okay, and there are small fluctuations, gradient fluctuation. And at some point, the helicase is able to actually start unwinding. And it unwinds with some well-defined velocity here, there. You see also that there are slower region, faster region, and things like that. And what turns out that here it opens completely the hairpin, and then it falls down. And the hairpin just rebridizes very quickly. This is rebridization of the DNA, and this goes on at extremely high speed there, typically 1,000 base pair per second, if there is nothing in the way. And the second burst is nearly the same, except the falling edge is definitely not the same as this one here. Okay? And so I want just to explain you that, because this is a very interesting trick which helps us a lot in the experiment. So what goes on is very simple, is that this helicase is unwinding, and remember that contrary to my drawing, the helicase is bounding around DNA. So it's an hexamer which forms an hexamer around the DNA, and then it moves around the DNA. So what goes on here is that when it unwinds, everything is nearly simple. So when it unwinds, the helicase is in front of the fork and pushing on the DNA, and so everything is simple. Then when it goes after the loop, okay, what turns out that the helicase is still working on the single strand. There is no reason why it should fall. Well, it can fall in some occasion. And now the hairpin is trying to close behind, and it's finding the helicase on the way. Okay, so in the two things are very different. In one occasion, the helicase is unwinding the DNA. In this region, in the falling edge, what is going on is that the helicase is preventing the rezipping of the DNA. So in one case, this is a caterpillar action. It's pushing on DNA and opening the DNA. And in the other situation, you just see the full speed of the caterpillar push on the back. Okay? And what is very surprising is that you don't see here we are at high force, but if we do the same thing at smaller force, what we find is that the two velocities are very different, and it gives us the velocity of unwinding versus the velocity of rezipping here. So this is here a lot of events, as you can see, the same kind of explanation. Now, if we add the primase. So now we put at the same time primase and helicase. And what goes on is two things. The primase is synthesizing a small RNA primer. Okay, so depending on what you put on the solution, you can have the primase working or not. If you don't put ribonucleotide in the solution, primase has no activity. Okay? If you put some, then you can get activity. And indeed, what we find is that there is activity. So if we have just the primase and the helicase, we find exactly the same burst that I've shown you before in this experiment, unwinding and rezipping, and you see that here the two velocities are different. If we now put ribonucleotide and primase, so primase is able to work, well, we find various things. We find that first, in some occasion, we find that the leading edge burst is different here. That is, there is a slowdown at some point and a fast catch-up, and then we resume to the normal velocity there. Okay? So I'll try to explain that in a minute. So it's very easy to distinguish because you have a very clear jump here. And we find another kind of behavior. So we find the two behavior in the same for the same molecule. We still find that it unzips. And when it rezips, it blocks. And it blocks at various places. And it stays blocked for a few seconds, and then it decays. Okay? And we only see that if we put the primase and the ribonucleotide, of course. And so the idea is that what is going on is, again, something is preventing the closing of the hairpin here. And so at the beginning, we were thinking that it was just a primer, that the primase that laid on the single strand DNA that formed a duplex and that prevents the rezipping. And it turned out that it is not a duplex because the primer is too small. It turned out that it is a piece of a primase. And so the interesting feature is that this proves the two things quickly. So the two things that we have shown here will show the two last mechanisms that I've displayed because I'm running out of time. So here what we find is very simple. The primase has dissociated from the helicase, and as the helicase go further, then it finds again that the hairpin cannot form because the primase is in the way. Okay, so this proves that here this is the dissociation mechanism which occur. Okay, and in the previous case here, it's just the opposite. Here you find that at this stage here, the velocity is divided by two, okay, and this is because there is a DNA loop sequester in the system, and so the extension is only due to one strand of the DNA. I'll show you that. And then when the DNA loop disappears, there is an abrupt jump in this system. So I'm running out of time, so I just go quickly through that. So I think the most interesting thing is the looping, so that we have seen here. And so the idea is just very simple. If there is a looping there, the extension that we measure between the two ends is smaller because there is a piece of single-strand DNA which is sequestered in this system. And it turns out that it exactly half of the DNA is sequestered, so it's why we get half on the velocity during this burst. And when the loop is released, then we catch up and resume to the normal velocity. So what we want to say is that we have seen these two mechanisms, dissociation and looping here. Dissociation can be seen because it changes the falling edge of this pulse, and here the looping makes this very strange behavior in the leading edge of this system. So since I'm running out of time, I'll just finish here and let you ask questions. And these are people involved there.
Questions? Well, that was very impressive. I have a question concerning the primer. So you say it would not obstruct, it would be so quickly displaced by branch migration, or how you see it?
Oh, because we have done the same experiment. So we open the DNA and we put a small primer in the solution. Okay, if this primer is long, let's say it's 20 base pair, you can actually block the hairpin for a very long time, minutes. Okay, so we have measured the blocking time versus the length of the polymer, of the primer, I'm sorry. And it turns out that it blocks very well for 10 base pair, for 9 base pair, or 8. But starting at 7, we don't see any more blocking. It means there is presumably some blocking, but the blocking is too small in time to be able to detect in our apparatus.
And then what's the size of a normal primer? Which you
The size of a normal primer is 5 base pair. Okay? And the other issue is that if we look at blocking by primer, it just first depends, as you may guess, on the length of the primer, but it also depends on the force we apply. Okay? And the blocking that we have here does not depend on the force that we apply. So presumably there is something else blocking, and presumably this is the primer which would stay bound there, maybe with some piece of primer.
Okay, and then I still wanted to go back to this where you said that there is a small trick here, because in fact you...
You
are turning to the drawing which you were making for the angle.
Oh,
yes.
Yes.
Because in fact you have to turn by 360 degrees in your system, otherwise the passage would not...
It's one turn.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there is another yes. element which comes. I mean, how close together are two crossings? Yes.
I knew that you were going to ask the question.
Okay.
Okay. So we have made a numerical simulation here. For the sake of simplicity, we have only turned by 3/4 of a turn. Okay. And so the idea is that each time we have an experiment, we can measure. So we measure this angle. So where I'm cheating? So we measure this angle by this sinus relation that I've shown you. Okay, so you get an angle there, and what I'm saying is that this angle is not the crossing angle of the DNA molecule. So what we do then is we plug the value that we have deduced from the experiment in the numerical simulation, and what we do, this is a Monte Carlo simulation, self-avoiding, and we prevent all the stuff there. We're done with Vologodsky, and so what we measure is there in this situation we measure the statistics of crossing angle at the smallest distance between the DNA molecules. So there is a small repulsion in the DNA, which is typically 5 nanometer or 2 nanometer. It does not depend that much. And so we measure the statistic of this angle. And the statistic of this angle displays this shape. Sorry. No, sorry, I made a mistake. Yes. So here it is. So this is the statistic of this angle, of this numerical simulation. And so it has a most preferable crossing probability. This turns out to be related to this angle, but not exactly equal. So this is where I'm cheating. Okay? And so by that, we can actually compute the exact angle.
Thank you very much.
Did that answer your question? Yes.
So I think it's fair that this would depend on the force.
There's a sense of actually the setup
Yes.
So you could pop up the loop by pulling. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So would you expect that depending on the force, I would expect that you can have different size loops. So is this something that?
Yes.
Because I would expect at least, no? Because
I'm sorry.
The longer the loop, the easier to pop it off.
The main result is that it does not depend for the primate stuff. I'm sorry.
Okay? Yeah.
For the primate stuff, it does not depend on the force.
It does not depend on the force.
It does not depend on the force. So we have varied. So yes, first we have measured dissociation and primates. So either looping or dissociation, and we found that most of the time we get dissociation. And in some occasion we get looping. We get both, but the ratio is quite not the same. We have done the experiment at two forces, relatively high force, 9 piconewton. So it's 9 piconewton is very near the itself of 12 piconewton, the opening of the DNA.
Yeah, but there could be also another force which you could compute probably. It's just the how much it takes to pop off a loop, no?
This is typically 15 piconewton.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said the favorite angle was 85 degrees.
Yes.
Does that match the
ideal
crystal structure for the DNA?
I don't think there is no crystal structure for topo 4 yet.
Oh, heavens
no. No. 30 years. Not going to ever. Unfortunately. No. What I should say is that there is a debate, because in Pizzarelli groups, they have measured that it was 60 degrees, and we think this is not right. Okay.
How much?
60 degrees.
60.
Wow. No. That was the result from their experiment. And Monte Carlo simulation.
The simulation is quite exciting.
Yeah, well, okay, but they use two things. They use the results. They use the difference between positive and negative positive and supercoiling grading experiment. So they measure a ratio between the efficiency in the experiment, and then they plug that in the Monte Carlo simulation. I agree.
There were a lot of gross errors.
I agree.
So I think that's
great. Well, you have to say that to our referee.
I think you're
thanks.
Well,